of the degree of observance?
Yes, a very, very excellent question. And let's take a practical hypothetical. Let's assume that a patient has executed a living will, and the living will basically says, I do not want to be put on a respirator. I do not want any life support. I do not want CPR. And let's assume that you, as a religious doctor, went ahead and you actually either performed a certain life-saving procedure or you told someone else to do it. So you violated the terms of the living will, and as a result, the patient might be quite distraught that they're on a respirator, that they're on dialysis, or whatever it would be. Now, theoretically, you have done a lot of things that civilly can be very, very serious. You have committed a battery. Any unauthorized medical procedure is the same as a battery, same as a baseball bat hitting somebody over the head. You have committed a professional violation, which could result in disciplinary action, including suspension, possibly even revocation of license, although that wouldn't be that likely. You can lose your hospital admitting privileges. There could be many, many consequences. So the question becomes, what am I supposed to do if my halachic obligations contradict the obligations that I have as a physician and as a citizen of the secular government that I'm living under? Now, there is a rule in halacha called Dina de Malchus Adina that basically says Jews are supposed to obey secular laws, but that's not absolute. Obviously, it's not absolute. If the secular law says work on Shabbos, you know, you obviously don't, and in order to save a life, I would violate the secular law. However, there is an argument in halacha that says that my obligation to save a life does not require me to forfeit my livelihood and endanger my license. Now, why that should be so is an interesting question. Perhaps because this way you will be disabled from saving future lives.
Correct.
At later dates. So halacha does say that the mitzvah to save a person may be overridden if the cost to you would be a jeopardization of your own livelihood. So that's a technical out. I'm not saying that's necessarily an ethically satisfying answer. Perhaps the ethically satisfying answer is, I'll do what I can no matter what the consequences to me. But at least in terms of a loophole, you do have that way out. Now let me emphasize as well that vis-a-vis the non-Jewish patients, your answer is much, much easier. You simply follow the law of the land, because the halachic rules in question here only apply towards your obligation of towards Jews. It would not apply towards the non-Jews. Non-Jews would be governed by the secular standard.
Could I just a question? Yeah. Following up on one, any physician who would, as soon as they walk into that hospital, as soon as they have a position, they have to know what they would do in a situation, whatever the situation is, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So what I'm basically saying is that in most cases, you are permitted to comply with the terms of the living will, even if the directives in the living will are against halacha, with the following exception. There are some important exceptions, meaning you can follow the living will to the degree of not initiating aggressive interventions. But when it comes to terminating the interventions, which might be called active homicide, active euthanasia, you would not be permitted to actually do that. You'd have to let someone else do it, which is fine. You don't have to be the one shutting off the respirator or the light. And vis-a-vis you as the passive observer, you are behaving in a passive way. So,
are you referring to Jewish patients or non-Jewish?
No. Non-Jewish patients. Well, that would be true even to non-Jewish patients, because the obligations of aggressively intervening are less towards non-Jews, but the prohibition of active homicide will apply to a non-Jew as well. So you cannot shut off the respirator even for a non-Jewish patient. You see, because that's considered to be active euthanasia.
But that is precisely my question, because again, then we are discussing the concept of palliation.
Yeah.
And I know that we're going to have the session on organ donation,
right,
donation after cardiac death, and all these concepts, which in fact are part of the civil law of the land,
yep,
the concept of terminal withdrawal of support, palliation with removal because of very short life expectancy, terminal illness. Those are my daily questions.
Yep.
You know, that's what I do. You know, that's what I do day in and
well,
day out.
Well, again, vis-a-vis your non-Jewish patients, you can follow the terms of the living will, except you cannot be involved in any type of active termination. You
but
just delegate.
Who writes the order?
That would be interesting. You know, it would be interesting. If you're writing the order, shut off the respirator, you should not be the one who writes that order. You should not write that order. You can write most orders, don't do this, don't do this. In other words, as long as what you're saying is what not to do, that's called passive. You should not be the one.
Do not keep the valve open.
Okay, something like that. And either way, the doctor often is not the person who actively, you know, shuts off the dial. Usually that's done by a nurse
by the respiratory therapist.
Or whatever it would be. In other words, the basic distinction is that anything that would be classified as murder in the eyes of halacha, you're not allowed to do. Anything that is simply classified as failure to render medical assistance, that vis-a-vis the non-Jew, you can certainly follow. And vis-a-vis the Jew, you may also follow, if otherwise you would be subject to potential disciplinary sanctions. So, by and large, you know, I think you're able to accommodate to this particular regimen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be that difficult. But once again, as a physician, though, your orientation should be towards supporting life and towards pain relief and those things, and give people hope. You know, instead of, you know, the whole idea of terminating life support is kind of based on a sense of hopelessness.
Yeah.
And if we can give people hope, that will often give them a reason to want to keep living one way or the other. Yeah.
You said a person in comatose can't feel pain.
I said, yeah.
But they've found many cases where people in comatose are somewhat inside their body's trapped, and they're aware and functional. You can somewhat even contact them, and basically they can talk to loved ones, and they find ways to communicate.
Yeah.
So a person trapped in their body, there's nothing more painful than that. There's actually a case where a person wrote a book. I don't know if you're aware of this. Basically, he can move his left eye. So the person would move basically the letters of the alphabet in front of him, and he'd wink when he wanted that. He'd wrote a book that way.
Amazing.
The person is trapped inside his body is the most painful thing possibly.
Well, it certainly is. There was a woman in California, I think her name was Bouvier or something, and she was that way. She was trapped, totally paralyzed, not a coma, but totally paralyzed. And she could not even kill herself because she was unable to even do that. And she petitioned, she went through the whole courts of California. She fought for many, many years to establish her right to have her life support disconnected.
How did she do that?
I mean, how did she do it? I mean, she hired lawyers. I mean, how did she communicate? Well, she communicated with moving her eyes or whatever.
You're talking about the Locked-in syndrome?
She was
conscious. She was not. It was not a locked in.
Cases,
she was,
though,
yeah.
Where the person's actually in comatose, and they can do like MRIs basically ways to see that there's activity going on in their brain.
But what I wanted to say about this case was, many, many years she was fighting for her right to terminate her life support, and when she finally won her case, she says, "Now I want to live." She says, "I've shown I have autonomy. I've shown I have control. I've shown that I can make decisions. Okay, I'm going to live." But she needed that sense of self-respect to be able to go on. Now, you're describing a very different phenomenon. You're not describing quadriplegic. You're not describing paralysis. You are describing people who seemingly are comatose, but there are various levels of communication and brain activity that might not be perceptible to a more casual observer. And being locked in, certainly. I mean, I don't even like to imagine it because it really seems to be so devastating. On the other hand, let me ask you the question. Somebody wrote a book based on their living through this.
So the book wasn't.
What was the? Did the book describe what life was like for them? Did it have a pessimistic tone, an optimistic tone?
I read about the book.
No, I'm just curious how the person himself would view his life. Again, it's hard for us to know these things. Stephen Hawking. Okay, it's not exactly the same, but you know, Stephen Hawking, with all that he suffers, I think would consider his life to be good and positive and productive and constructive. No, so that'd be fascinating. I think that'd be a fascinating book to look at. Mm-hmm. How does a person look at his life from that perspective?
Point, the eye just projecting.
That's correct. That's correct. That's really the subtle problem. Mm-hmm. We're looking at this as a totally unbearable state.
And he's still able to somewhat contact his family.
Yeah. It's very strange. God implanted in us amazing.
It also shows the element that he is his being inside him, not his body. And he can't use his body at all, but he's still sucking.
I understand. In many, many ways, you know, there's a metaphor that Hasidic literature uses in which the body is described as a horse and the soul is described as a rider. And we're riding. Our job in life is to control. Like, our body is not us. And in a way, you exactly have that situation where the person is not his body. His body is this useless shell that
life inside the vessel.
Actually, it's not so useless. It's, you know, keeping digestion and other things. But it really reminds a person of what their essence is. Very, very strange. Yeah.
We have an extreme case of ALS in our community. Mm. It's declining very, very quickly. Basically, it's trapped in the body. It's capable to write with his eye on the computer.
Yeah.
We suffered some tremendous loss in my personal family. He wrote, it took him about 6 hours to write a wonderful letter to us as part of the Shiva Nichumim. And his main point was, and it was related to our tragedy, to my son, that you have to do things despite the difficulties. And that's exactly what he was going through. Wonderful letter.
You know, those are.
You can write him off just like that because
No, those really are the heroes of the world, the people that have such devastating challenges.
Yeah.
And they're able to find hope, and they really serve as an inspiration. And if we talk about what the purpose of their life is, you know, that's it. I mean, to be able to write such a letter and to give such a message.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous, tremendous thing. But, you know, again, I'm going to look for that book because I'd be very, very curious how he would describe his life. Very, very good point. But as I say, I think that you can work within the parameters of... lawyers face a similar issue, not with medical treatment, but with confidentiality. You know, just as doctors, you know, there are duties of confidentiality, right? Clients tell you things. Mm-hmm. And yet, sometimes halacha says, I gotta reveal confidences to protect people. So if my client tells me that he murdered two children, and he even tells me where the children are buried, under the secular confidentiality rules, unless there's a risk he'll murder again, I am not allowed to reveal that information. I could be disbarred.
When you say murders, of course there's a risk of murder again.
Well,
once you can pull the trigger.
Well, that's true, but secularly, that's not the way it works. In other words, if my client tells me he will murder, then I must reveal it, and that's also true for, in fact, that's the famous.
Because the clearer point is far surpassed the point where he's able to murder.
You can't apply.
Well, all I'm saying is that
you can't apply.
Yeah, all I'm saying is that from a secular perspective, the concept of because somebody has murdered, he'll murder again. Now, you might say empirically that's
from a Jewish perspective, it's because
no, that's what I'm saying. That's exactly my point. My point basically is that halacha may require that you reveal information that secular law says you can be disbarred for revealing. Once again,
same psychiatry,
right?
It's exactly
right. Psychiatry has the same distinction, right? The very famous Tarasov doctrine, the name of a case. That's where the psychiatrist didn't reveal a patient had told him he was going to kill his girlfriend. Psychiatrist kept it confidential. He killed the girlfriend, and the psychiatrist was held liable for failure to reveal that information.
Wow.
On the other hand, if a person simply tells you about the past things that he's done, that would be confidential. But halacha may require disclosure. So
there are, according to some, and that's still more than a fifth of your salary, you lose your license.
Yeah, I see you know what I'm referring to. This is the yesod of what I'm saying, that if the obligation of disclosure is because of the commandment l'samad al dam riecha, and it could result in losing your license, that is treated as more than a fifth. And like some opinions, that's correct. If you treat it like a negative commandment, this heter would not apply. But if you treat it like a positive commandment, then you would not have to.
But some say even if it's a negative commandment, it's passive.
That's exactly the svar. Nobody says it's a positive. They treat it like a positive because it's a negative that you fulfill by.
There's two.
I'm not sure would be an accurate way. I mean, it's written as a negative. You can't call it a positive, but you say
it can be defined as a positive, as a mitzvah said, because it's negative, or it could be a passive negative commandment, which would also be negative.
Okay. Yeah, but that's exactly right. The din that I said is presupposing that we look at it as a passive negative or a positive commandment. That's right, and you don't have to give up more than a fifth. Like the other view, we would be much stricter, 100%. Yeah. So there are going to be conflicts, but I think overall you're able to navigate the conflicts. You know, there was a case in New York that rabbis were very afraid of. You know, New York State has a rule that clergymen are supposed to keep confidences, that if somebody comes to me and tells me something, right? So listen to this interesting case. A woman was undergoing a divorce, and she told her rabbi, a very, very prominent rabbi, that she's no longer going to the mikveh, that although she was still having relations with her husband, you know, she was not going to the mikveh because she wanted to stick him. So he went and he told the husband that your wife's not going to the mikveh, you can't have relations with her anymore. Okay. Anyway, they got divorced, and then they're having a child custody determination. And the husband's argument is that the wife is not going to raise the children in the manner to which we were accustomed, which is Orthodox life. And the proof is that he called the rabbi to the stand, and the rabbi had to testify that she told me he wasn't going to the mikveh. So she got reduced custody because of that communication. So she sued the rabbi in the courts of New York for damages because the rabbi violated his duty of confidentiality, resulting in her losing the custody of her children. So I can tell you that the rabbis all over the United States were very afraid of that precedent. The lower court in New York actually said he's liable. It got reversed by the higher court in New York, which is called the New York Court of Appeals. So they basically said that she's not entitled to damages. But that would be an example, Baruch Hashem, but that would be an example where halacha says you got to disclose it. Secular law says not to disclose it.
There comes marriage. Huh? Comes to all these cases where one of the spouses has some congenital malfunction or something.
Right.
And she's not willing to expose it.
Right. And here, you know, people raise the question, well, wait a second, how could the rabbi be sued for keeping his religion? Isn't there a freedom of religion? I mean, First Amendment. You can't penalize a person for keeping their religion, right? That's a First Amendment right. But unfortunately, that's really not true. There's a very, very famous case, again, it's a very problematical case. It's called the Smith case. This was an opinion by a justice that we normally like a lot, Justice Scalia, who sometimes comes to Chabad conferences. But this involved the use of peyote mushrooms by Native American tribes. And they were being prosecuted for violating narcotics laws. And their defense was, it's part of our religion. So Scalia wrote that as long as the state is making a general law about no drug use, they're not singling out religion. Religion has to keep normal laws, right? So people were very worried. That would mean, theoretically, the state could prosecute you for giving kiddush wine to your under 18, whatever it would be. You know, come in the middle of a seder, you know, and the like. Because as long as it's a neutral law, there is no First Amendment, there's no freedom of religion. That was called the Smith case, and it's a very, it's a very, very controversial case for people who believe in religious freedom and the like. Yeah, but this last thing that was brought up before the break, it was brought up about at the end of last session about your question about how do you allocate resources when you have scarce resources. I want to add something to the discussion here too. That is, you got to differentiate between what you would call micro allocation and macro allocation. Micro allocation are the decisions that you make in the hospital itself. Meaning, I got 14 beds in the ICU, and I have 200 people coming, and I got a triage, and I got to decide who gets it and the like. Right? Those are the decisions that you make based on who is most likely to benefit from the medical treatment. So it's not based on social worth. It's not based on spiritual value. It's simply based on who are the healthiest
people.
Physical
survival.
Well, it's actually a combination of two different factors which kind of almost run in contradiction. One is who will benefit the most, and the other is who has the least opportunity to wait. It's two different weighing
factors. Who is the sickest and,
who is most likely to survive. Again,
correct.
That may be two contradictory lists almost. But you got to make, because sometimes if you give it to the sickest, then the people who would have had the best chance to survive, by the time you get to them, they're not going to survive. So in a way, you've kind of
it's a definitive time decision.
Right.
If you have 20 people showing up in the ED, you do a rapid triage,
right,
and that's how you make decisions. You don't wait for
someone
who's not as sick to become sicker.
Right.
And that's
right. You have to make the decision. So that we'll call a bedside decision. That's, I got the patients, they're in the hospital, this is what I do. But macro allocation is a very different. Macro allocation refers to the higher level budgeting decisions that society makes.
Correct.
Let's take the following example. You might wonder, if saving a life is so important, then we ought to put 100% of our budget in healthcare. Why? What is the halachic right to build a hotel or build a museum or build a school or build a playground? Because keep in mind, every dollar that I'm not putting into the healthcare system results in less healthcare than would otherwise be there. And you could probably even translate it into numbers of lives lost.
Correct.
So if you really took the idea that saving a life is the most important decision we could ever make, then there would be no heker to do anything other than save lives.
Quality of life as well.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So the answer would be that although once I'm in the hospital, once I have the dialysis machines, my imperative is to save lives, but in the allocation of resources, society can take a long-term view of what will create a better, beneficial society. So a society where everybody's alive, but there are no museums, there are no roads, there are no schools, would create...
No roads, you can't get to the hospital.
Well, you're right. That's another issue. But even things that are purely recreational, which means halacha rejects utilitarianism and quality of life in the hospital setting, but it does acknowledge it as a legitimate concept in the societal setting. And I'll give you a little example of how halacha does allow us to look at the future of things, even if right now there's a present reality that would dictate a different response. And that is the issue of redeeming of captives. Unfortunately, when Jews were kidnapped, they still are sometimes, so there is a great, great mitzvah to ransom the captives. Jews were often seized for ransom and the like. And the halacha is you do not pay excessive ransom for hostages.
Mm-hmm. Excessive to compromise the community. That's
And the reason is because by giving in to excessive demands, now I'm not defining excessive, you will be encouraging future kidnappings. By the way, this is a highly controversial issue that Israel faces. Israel always gives in to excessive demands. when we want to get our soldiers back, or whatever.
The last 25 years.
Well, okay, but yeah.
I was there.
Okay, as far, yeah, but you know, Israel will release, you know, a thousand terrorists, you know, in exchange for, in exchange for a dead body, not just a live body, and the like. And people have criticized this halachically because they have said, number one, you're encouraging hostage taking. And number two, it's even worse than giving them money because you're putting back the terrorists into the system that killed. But what do you see from here? You see from the Gemara a fascinating idea that although you have somebody whose life is in danger, you have a hostage, his life is in danger, we are permitted not to intervene, not only permitted, we are commanded not to intervene to save that person's life. Because otherwise there'll be a long-term consequence.
Tosafot gives an opinion that when it's for pikuach nefesh,
that's right. Tosafot says for pikuach nefesh we would indeed, and Rav Avadya Yosef actually relies on that opinion to validate Israel. But most Rishonim do not agree with Tosafot. Most Rishonim say that the Gemara's, the Mishnah's ruling is even b'makom pikuach nefesh mamish. So you see over there the concept that we do look at long-term consequences of things. Or everything. What about the idea of constructing a building? We know actuarially that there are going to be some accidents, some construction accidents. Meaning every time you put up a skyscraper, a big building, you know somebody's going to die. You don't know who it is. So you think about this. So why am I allowed to engage in, well, okay.
It has to do with the risk.
Yeah.
The reasonable risk.
Right. So the question becomes this. The question becomes, you know, people say, now again, the question is whether halacha recognizes this. People will differentiate between what they call actual lives and statistical lives. You ever heard this? Like, that when there's an actual person, you know, who's going to die if I, you know, move, do this, I'm not going to allow that to happen. But people don't look at actuarial realities as real things. And the fact that I'm going to embark on a project that's going to result in somebody's death is somehow not taken as seriously by people.
Smoking.
Huh?
Smoking, we hear about in the whole Zasha, though. It's not an actual person that's going to die. It's a theoretical, statistical reality.
I think somebody. I don't know if Dr. Reichman or somebody was, I think, giving a share on risk here.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be an issue. So again, statistical risks are dealt with even in the halakhic system differently than a person that's actually endangered at the time. Now, with smoking, they play the game a different way. I mean, I'll tell you, smoking, there are different ways of approaching it. Some poskim have forbade it in recent years, but the traditional consensus was not to forbid it.
Not before they knew exactly how
they were. Well, okay.
Poskim used to think it was healthy.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about after the certain, you know, after the certain general.
Well, it's hard to make something which is so accepted, transparent.
Yeah. I will say, you know, in Israel, Israelis are heavy smokers, and religious Israelis are even heavier smokers. But I've noticed myself, even there, there's been a diminution a little bit, so it's not as intense.
Why don't you think the more yeshivish rebbeim will ask for it? I have many friends in the mirror who are just, you know.
The more yeshivish will ask for it, or won't ask for it?
Won't.
I don't know. I'm not sure why it should correlate with yeshivish or not yeshivish.
No, I'm saying I have friends in that.
You're correct. The more yeshivish tend not to asr, but I don't know logically why there would be
a cultural reason.
It's kind of a cultural thing. I think it's a cultural thing. You know, in the yeshiva world, they like to keep everything traditional. So if the tradition was, oh, my Rosh Hashiva smoked, you could smoke. You know, what's the difference? You're correct. They used to think smoking was healthy. In the 1930s, there were advertisements about the health benefits of smoking and digestion.
Not a cough in a car load. You remember the ad?
That's right.
Can't hold non-filtered cigarettes.
That's right.
It made sense. You look at a person who's smoking, right. He's stressed, he's angry, all of a sudden he smokes, he's happy, he's relaxed, and everything's great.
Well, maybe there are. I mean, you know. There could be health benefits along with the danger benefits, you know, danger. But I want to make a point. You know, Mark Twain once said, and this is an interesting concept about risk. that there are lies and damn lies and statistics. And statistics can be expressed in different ways, in which a danger could either be magnified or a danger could be minimized. Now, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, so I'm going to make up numbers just to illustrate my point. Let's take a certain pesticide, right? So if you spray a certain pesticide, this increases the risk of carcinogen, the risk of cancer, by a factor of 1,000. Okay? Now let's assume that the natural incidence of the disease is 1 in 1,000,000. And by increasing it by a factor of, or let's say 1 in 10,000,000, and by increasing it by a factor of 1,000, it's now what? 1 in 100,000. So there are two ways I could describe this. I could say 1 out of 100,000 people are going to get sick. That may not sound so bad. 100,000 people, well, what's driving, you know, whatever it is. The other is, if you do this, you have a 1,000 times greater chance of getting disease. That sounds pretty bad. Meaning, sometimes a risk in absolute terms may not be so excessive, but the magnitude of risk incrementally compared to, right? So it all depends. So the interesting thing is, when halacha prohibits dangerous activities, is danger just defined by objective risk or by magnitude of risk as compared to what it would be without the risk factor? Meaning, if you go from, okay, I'm just making up numbers, from 10 million to 1 million, right? You've increased your risk by 10,000%, but it's still 1 out of 1,000,000. Right, so that's an interesting issue.
Doesn't that depend on the time period? Like the Maram Sheikh is like a 1 in 1,000 of being like crazy ridiculous, but yeah. Nowadays 1 in 1,000 would be like, you would never take that surgery, ever, if there was 1,000 chance you'd die.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. I think perceptions of what is risk averse, what is reasonable risk change, that's also included in the concept of Shomer Pesayim Hashem. That's right. But I think even with smoking, you know, you're going to have similar issues. Smoking greatly magnifies risks, but it's still true, I think. Again, I might be wrong. Most smokers are not going to get lung cancer.
Correct.
Right. So you still
majority
have
majority of smokers
are not
going to
get lung
cancer.
Majority of smokers never have any
lung
right,
disease.
Right. So you great.
Everyone says it's right. Not going to be me. And that's
right. Right. No. No. So you're greatly increasing the risk, but it's still an activity that is.
But you're also endangering others.
Oh, okay. That's a
second. That's the only reason why I should be asked.
Okay. That is a separate issue. That is a separate issue. A secondhand smoke. In fact, I had the Shaila. I wasn't sure how to respond. He didn't ask me at the time, but he asked me afterwards. That is, somebody went to a wedding, and in the wedding hall, two Me'asharim elderly gentlemen were smoking. So this person who said he had sensitivity to secondhand smoke just went over to them and just pulled the cigarettes.
That's not the right way to do it.
I don't know. Maybe it was just a matter of. Maybe I'm not sensitive enough to secondhand smoke, but I thought that was awful. I thought that was disrespectful, a lack of derech eretz, without even... I mean, I asked the person, why didn't you ask them to put it out? He said, well, because they wouldn't have. Why didn't you ask them to walk out of the building?
Why didn't you just take a different route?
They wouldn't have. Why didn't you walk out of the building? You know,
right.
Again, it's not the way to do it. But yeah, halakhically, there is a very strong basis to absolutely prohibit secondhand smoking in a building, at least.
Same thing when it comes to vaccinations. Like, what you want to do shouldn't have to affect other people.
Yeah. Well, vaccinations is fascinating because optimally the safest thing for my children is, if everyone else vaccinates, I'll skip the vaccination. And, you know, that's perfect. You know, my kids are protected and from everything. Problem
because
is...
nobody else is going to get
right,
sick.
Right. The problem is, of course, if everybody makes that calculation,
correct.
You've created a dangerous world. And therefore, you should not be permitted to make decisions unless that decision could be made by everybody else as well. And if everybody else would make the same decision, the world would be safe. Because they'd say, hey, go ahead and make it. But you cannot make decisions that are safe only if you make them, because the same right you have, they have. Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, this is a serious concern in the Orthodox community right now, because there is a growing anti-vaccination movement in the Orthodox community, and what's a little... Well, because, you know, because of perceived health risk. You know, the old autism thing, which I think is largely discredited, but people bring it up, and people feel very strongly about it.
Press himself was basically kicked out of the...
Yeah, I understand, but it seems to have gotten a renewed energy. People are bringing it up. And I have to say that the vast majority of rabbis, both here in Israel, are very much in favor of compulsory vaccination, but there is one eminent rabbi... influenced by his wife, who does feel that he is convinced vaccinations are dangerous. This is Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky. He's not a crazy person. He's a very, very well-respected person. And he is absolutely, he's a strong advocate against vaccination.
Are people also concerned about...
That's a very dangerous position.
I think it is a dangerous position.
You put the community at risk, and no one has the right to do that.
Yeah. Well, I understand.
The risk statistically is greater for the community to have non-vaccinated members than it is for.
Well, you need
a
what is it?
Possibly
the phenomenon of what's called herd immunity. You need a certain percentage. Is that 670, 80%?
75 to 85%.
Right. Once you're below that, you have a significant risk of infectious diseases coming back. He took the position, again, I'm not defending it, I'm against it. In fact, I wrote an article specifically rejecting that position. But he took the position that, measles aren't as bad as autism. He said, all right, let people get measles, and, they'll recover, and... they'll get better, and
I realize.
Isn't there also this hashash, this concern about the corruption in terms of the statistics in government, and people aren't trusting the risk rates and what government says? Is that like a possible reason?
Yeah, I think that's so also. I think that's so also.
What created that?
You know, it's part of the populist revolt against big pharma, big medicine, drug companies, how much money they make with vaccinations.
What does that have to do with? I mean, they don't believe anything they say. They think they just want money.
Yeah, so they say they're just pumping up. They've created a perception of epidemics.
Life expectancy.
Right? But it's crazy. I mean, vaccinations, I think, is one of the great success stories. In public health, starting with smallpox and then polio and everything else. I mean, it's just hard to imagine how one could support, let's say, not vaccinating for polio or whatever. I mean, within memory of many people, they remember the summers were a horrendous fear of children who would get polio in the swimming pools.
Well, do they have any updates on the fact that it came back up in the Israeli sewer systems?
There was dramatic concern. I
don't know.
This was around. Was it 2 years ago? I think it was 2 years ago. They found some polio in feces in the sewer system. So they were very, very concerned. So they did a renewed campaign of oral vaccination.
Because I happened to walk in at that moment, and I apologize, Rabbi, for walking in like that. But back to the idea of the statistical person.
Yes.
Halacha protects the statistical person.
Well, yes, the halacha that protects statistical people actually is a mitzvah in the Torah itself. It's very interesting. The Torah requires that you build a ma'akeh. Ma'akeh is a fence
around
your roof.
Though, but you were talking, excuse me for interrupting, but weren't you talking about the actual construction of the building, where it is known, and people have been building buildings from the area, it's known that some workers are going to be injured or killed.
So you're asking me what allows you to build the building in the first place, you mean? So the answer that I would say to that is that when society makes decisions, it can look for the long-term future benefits. And if a building will benefit more people than the... Yeah. Okay. That might be a similar thing. Meaning, we can look at long-term benefits even at the expense of individuals who are going to suffer. That is a basis. That's a utilitarian basis for constructing a society that in the overall picture of things will be a better society. And that's why we build buildings, that's why we build libraries, and I think you're correct, that could be the basis for vaccination, in which if I am a member of society, statistically I could be forced to bear certain risks that in the long term will make society healthier, more productive, and the like.
What about the sanctity of an individual life? It takes even precedence over Shabbos.
No, that's correct. But once again, we would differentiate between the person who is already endangered, in which case I got to do everything,
statistical.
And statistic. That's exactly the difference. That's really the point between the statistical life or statistical risk and the person actually in the state of danger. Yeah.
I remember reading the article on vaccination, and you mentioned at the end this concept of vaccinating small children for the purpose of hoping that it would somehow help other people who didn't vaccinate.
Yeah.
I'm unaware of what's the scientific concept that we're implying.
You know, I'm trying to remember, the article was written quite a long time ago. The issue there was...
The issue was putting little kids at risk.
You're putting them at risk in order to help, in order to prevent...
Well, they were going to get the virus from being exposed to these kids? What was the purpose?
Yeah, that was it.
How exactly does that work?
I mean, how does the virus spread?
Mm-hmm.
Just from exposure, meaning...
You were going to give them an active virus that would infect them?
Which vaccine are you talking about?
Oh, yeah. Now I remember what was going on.
Life vaccine versus a tetanus.
Yeah.
This
was a crazy thing. Again, I wasn't sure I fully understood it either. It was some crazy idea that you're vaccinating the kids, perhaps with some type of live virus.
But some vaccines are life attenuated virus.
That could
it's
what?
Life,
that that.
Kind of impaired.
Yeah. That would then what?
The vaccine,
in other words, you're dealing with.
I wasn't understanding how it was going to hopefully help others. I mean, this was going to spread.
No, which would trigger. Yeah. In other words, maybe it would trigger. It would trigger some immunity response. Meaning they couldn't.
I never heard of that.
Yeah. There was. If you can find the article, I can.
It was contagious, or it was something that would do some sort of crazy, just desired effect without giving them the disease.
You know, I honestly don't remember.
Life-attenuated virus creates immunity without creating disease.
But to the person that gets it, right? The person that gets the vaccine.
The person who is given the vaccine.
So the purpose was for others, meaning they were going to give these kids the vaccine to give other people immunity.
Right. Now, the issue in Israel was that there was an elderly... No, this is very crazy. There was an elderly population.
Okay.
It would be too dangerous to vaccinate them.
Okay.
They would get ill. But there was a theory that by vaccinating children,
right,
somehow the elderly could be exposed to the children, and that would trigger some type of immune response that might protect them. Can you find that out?
I'm trying to construct.
Yeah, I have to remember what it was.
If you're talking about probably a closed community,
yeah,
and if you, I think that the way I would look at it would be probably, if you vaccinate children, therefore you will diminish the chance for the elders in the community for active exposure.
Okay,
that would be the concept. That would be
simpler, yeah.
Kids would be healthy hands, they wouldn't be infected, and therefore the chance of infecting the elders.
Yeah.
Would be a lot less. I mean, again, I'm improvising, but...
Yeah.
But you aren't really, they're being immune, they're just not being exposed.
Yeah. They won't be,
because
correct.
Because the community is...
You will make the overall community healthier, if you will, and then, you know... But again, if you're talking about a relatively kind of enclosed or whatever...
Not Jewish.
Because this is the only kind. Well, I don't know. I can fantasize and come up with some other more crazy ideas.
Okay, this is what happened. I'm reading from something I wrote. Due to the discovery of the poliovirus in some sewage found in Ashdod and Beersheba, the Israeli government has implemented a nationwide polio booster program. inoculating children with a live attenuated virus delivered orally.
Right.
Unfortunately, the complexities of the program are such that one cannot issue any halachic opinion, etc. But the use of live virus rather than dead strain carries distinct dangers and risks. That is why Israel discontinued the use of live virus in 2005, and they brought it back for this booster. Second, the purpose of the program is not to benefit the inoculated children. They have already received regular polio shots of dead virus, but to provide protection to non-inoculated adults through a complicated mechanism of the live virus spreading to these people and giving them the equivalent of a vaccine.
That doesn't ask. What?
That's I don't know if it makes sense scientifically, but that's how it does.
That's what I'm asking. First of all, it has worked scientifically. You're giving them, you're just going to give them the virus, or you're giving them some sort of immunity without them getting the virus?
I'm assuming what happens is the virus is somehow...
So they're just getting this inoculation.
They catch the virus. That's correct. Now, why that's better than the vaccination itself, I don't know.
These people are probably refusing to get vaccinated.
Okay, that might be. So essentially, you're using the kids. You're using the kids as a delivery system.
Yeah.
For the adults.
Some sort of like, if you're not going to inoculate, we'll inoculate you.
We'll inoculate you through the kid. Yeah.
But then you're using kids.
No, that's what I meant. So essentially, you're using kids as human shields.
Why don't you use adults? Like, they have a better immune system. You should use adults.
I don't know.
Furthermore, how is that like?
I don't know why they decided.
Ethically, how is that like if? A person is allowed to decide, I don't want to get inoculated. How can we create a system which is the entire purpose is just to get around you deciding not to do it?
Well, you're just exposed to stuff in the air. You know, you don't want to be inoculated, okay? But
it's ethically the same thing as forcing you to inoculate.
It's secondhand inoculation.
Secondhand.
But it's the entire purpose is not for the kids.
Yeah. It's a very interesting concept. But the thing I compared it to the notion that. You don't endanger one person to save another person. And you can't use kids giving them the risk of a live virus in order to save somebody who has the option of taking his own inoculation.
Same thing with forcing someone to undergo a kidney donation.
Right. Yeah, it's a good question, but I haven't looked into it since then. Okay, well, maybe, I don't know, maybe we'll stop here. And you all, thank you very much for... the questions and the comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.